Hello, once again, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today to answer your gardening questions, it's our own green team, Greg Ward and Fred Breglia. Greg Ward runs Ward's Nursery, a lawn and garden resource in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Fred Breglia, an ISA-certified arborist, is the director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. If you have any questions or strategies or tips for the garden, we'd love to hear them now. Of course, Fred and Greg are experts, and they're here to help make your garden grow. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. Greg and Fred, welcome back. Gentlemen, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing well.
It's not a trick question. I just wondered how you're doing.
I was afraid it was there.
No, absolutely not.
You stumped us already.
Wow. All right. We can stop the show. We'll go on to the next one. You know, I'd be interested to hear from anyone of our listeners who tried Fred's uniquely disgusting method for getting rid of cucumber beetles. And if you missed the show last time, it was to round up some cucumber beetles from your garden, put them in a blender and grind them up, and then paint them on the leaves of the plant. So if you're at home at 800-348-2551, and you've done this, if you're sick enough to do it, I want to hear from you. Fred says it really works. We didn't have the guts to try it.
And if you have and you've been successful, I think the next challenge should be flea beetles. You try to catch flea beetles. They're much smaller.
Yeah.
And they jump like fleas, much more difficult to put in a blender.
And it takes a lot more of them.
Yes, that too.
Well, we're off to a flying start, and we have a full line of calls, so let's get to them. Connie in Leverett. Connie, you're first. Hello? Hello, Connie? All right, well, goodbye, Connie. Let's go to Jane in Lenox. Jane, you're on. Okay.
Hey, lilies, we were beautiful this year.
Okay, now we hear you. Yes, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I had a question about day lilies. When they, you know, after they stop flowering and the leaves start to get a little bit brown, can they just be cut down or do they have to die back?
I would recommend leaving the foliage that's green for a bit longer. And then you can do a nice complete cleanup, maybe the 1st of September if you want to. So it does mean maybe getting back into the garden a couple of times and just taking out what's annoying you, and just to keep them pretty. And then maybe sometime early September, mid-September, you could do a nice kind of cut them in half, which will really sort of remove most of that. And then they will actually flush a little bit again September, October, and look good.
What do you mean cut them in half? Dig them up?
No, nope, just
you mean
take the foliage.
The
yeah, just to. Just,
oh, okay.
This is all because you don't want to look at it. You can certainly leave it all and allow
well,
it to do whatever it wants.
They take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
You know, but they were gorgeous this year.
Certainly, if they're getting in the way of other things, yeah, by all means, you know, thin that area out. You want to maintain, that view shed, and that's definitely a good idea.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Jane, thanks a lot. And I want to apologize to Connie and Leverett. Connie was probably there. We were having some problems on the board in the control room. So, Connie, call back. We'll try to get you right to the head of the line again. Fred Breglia is here. Greg Ward is here. It's The Gardening Show, 800-348-2551. Bill, where are you calling from, Bill?
I'm calling from the town of Root.
Ah, the town of Root. Well, a perfect show for you to call. How are you doing?
Okay. I'm doing fine, thanks.
Okay, you're up.
I'm trying to find out the best way to germinate sequoia seeds. I collected some earlier July 4th, and now I have a pile of them, and not sure which directions to follow online. I heard one that you just keep them moist in the refrigerator for 6 weeks and then go ahead and plant them.
Yeah, well, I know it's going to take a cold stratification to break the dormancy on those, and I've got a manual back at the office. It's a really comprehensive and very complete manual of basically propagation of all woody plants. So if you wanted to send me an email, perhaps, can you I'm assuming you're online?
Sure.
Yeah, if you could send me an email to fred@landisarboretum.org,
okay,
and then I'll give you the exact specifics, and this is coming off a really good, the definitive resource that I would say for propagation.
Okay, great.
And those are
because there are different opinions.
Yeah, it varies a lot. It will take a cold period to snap that, but I can give you the exact parameters, temperatures, what kind of media, everything.
Great.
Just shoot me an email. We'll take care of that for you.
Thanks very much.
You got it.
Hang on. Greg wanted
only
to get
that,
here.
That, you know, you whatever, you know, you're doing, they're saying 6 weeks, and do you want to germinate them into November, you know, October, November, and you'll have to keep them in the house over the winter. So just,
that's another thought
just keep that all in mind, that this should be maybe something you will do over the next few months or whatever, and germinate them in the spring so that you can then get them out right away.
Yeah, okay.
Everything in time with nature.
So. Yeah, well, the other thing to consider, which I'm assuming you're aware of, is that plant will not be cold hardy in our zone.
Yes, I realize.
Six,
that.
I think there's six or seven.
Yeah, probably maybe seven even.
Yeah.
It depends on whether it's do you know whether it's a coastal redwood or whether it's a giant sequoia.
Giant sequoia.
So that'll be cold hardier. So that'll probably be zone six probably.
And where's root?
They said minus 25 if you keep it mulched or there's a lot of snow cover. Where is root?
Yeah.
It's about 15 miles west of the Landis Arboretum.
Yep.
Oh.
Yep.
So how about
cool. Chilly out there.
Yeah, but you got a better shot if it's the Sequoia giganticum or giant sequoia. The sempervirens or the coastal redwood is going to be much more marginal. That's why I asked you. So,
okay.
Yeah, you got the right choice.
It's collected in Rhode Island. So
okay.
They were spoiled down there.
Well, good luck, Bill. We thank you.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Harriet in Woodstock. Harriet, you're on Vox Pop.
Oh, hi. I have a question about clematis. Mine, I know some people say clematis, but I say clematis.
Let's call the whole thing off.
Yes. Well, that's maybe the problem. They were so beautiful this spring. It was, I will say, in my garden, just the best spring ever. I've never seen the beauty of the blossoms and the quantity of growth ever. And now it's just a dried up, toasted little cornflake. Everything is struggling, and I can't really keep up with keeping it all alive. But the clematis, the bottom half of all of them, I have a Jackmani, I think I have a Niobe, I've got a fabulous, forgotten the name, but it's a native species with a magenta sort of trumpet-like flower that goes on and on and on for months. They're all completely dead-looking at the bottom of the vine, but they're clinging to life at the top. They've got green leaves, but the bottom half is completely dead and brown, and I'm just wondering if I should get in there and trim away the dead brown stuff, or should I just cut them all off in the fall?
I would say certainly don't, or certainly do actually go ahead and take any brown off that you want, removing any of that foliage now, just so that, again, it's out of your view and you're not looking at it. It has been a very hot, dry summer. You can, get some stress. Those are the older leaves, so they're going to be dropping off. This is, you know, true with kind of any plant you look at now. Those older leaves at the bottom, you know, are often discoloring.
Yes.
You know, making sure that those clematis are well mulched, keeping the soil temperatures lower is really helpful for them. Making sure they're well watered, not every day, but a thorough soaking maybe once a week, where we did get a little rain, but we're still certainly in a drought situation.
Yeah.
And then pruning clematis depends a little bit on exactly which variety you have. And there is some great stuff online about which group. There's basically an A, B, and C group. And so fitting your clematis into that group and pruning really in the spring is what's generally recommended.
Okay.
Spring pruning.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Harriet, thank you so much for the call. Judy in Albany. Judy, you're on.
Hi. I have a cedar tree that's about 30 years old, and for the last week, I've noticed that all these branches at the very tips of the tree are like, to me, I think there's squirrels are chewing them all off, and they're all over the ground. I've cleaned them up like three times this past week, and I go back out again today, and it's all over the ground again. Is it possible that squirrels could do that? I do have a lot of squirrels that fly up in that tree.
Yeah, that's actually not that uncommon for squirrels to do that. So,
because are they going to actually kill the tree by doing that?
No, there's never been a reported case of a tree death that I know of from squirrel damage.
But they're
damage,
like everywhere. It looks like it snowed branches all over the ground.
Yeah, they.
Why are they doing that?
You know, I have an oak tree in my backyard, very nice, large oak, and they do it to that oak tree pretty regularly as well. I have no idea other than they must either be getting some nutrients or they're hoping there's something on the end there that they will then harvest a little bit later on. These are guesses.
There are little berries on the cedar tree, but they all come, the branches are coming down with the berries attached to them, so I don't know. I can't think of any other reason why that would happen except that we do have a lot of squirrels.
And I think you could, if you spend any time in the backyard, you could sort of see the squirrels up there and actually doing it. So you could just determine that. But I would say that they could also be after the fruit. But as Fred said, they're doing some pruning. It's not ideal, but they certainly won't hurt the tree.
They won't kill the tree.
No, it's not definitely not going to kill it.
All right, so I guess we'll let the squirrels be then in this case?
Yes.
All right, very good. Judy, thanks a lot. We're going to take a break.
Okay, thank you.
You got it.
Bye.
Greg Ward, Fred Breglia are here, and we are taking your calls on gardening. 800-348-2551, the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. More Vox Pop on the way.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, a gardener's destination featuring trees, shrubs, water garden plants, and many perennials. Open Monday through Saturday, 8 to 5, Sundays, 8 to 4. StoriesNursery.com. Adventure Outfitter, Hadley, Massachusetts, offering outdoor clothing, camping equipment, cross-country skis, snowshoes, climbing equipment, canoes, and kayaks. Open evenings until 9, AdventureOutfitter.com. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts. A New England craft program offering workshops for adults and teens taught by master craftspeople on a 50-acre farm. Snowfarm.org. PS21, Performance Spaces for the 21st Century, Chatham, New York. Presenting Naomi Goldberg-Haas and Dances for a Variable Population in performance on Saturday, August 4th at 8 p.m. PS21chatham.org. And John G. Ullman & Associates in historic downtown Rhinebeck and Corning, providing comprehensive wealth management for individuals, families, and nonprofits since 1978. JGUA.com.
By the way, you're listening to brand new stuff from guitarist John Harrington, who, if you have seen Steely Dan over the last 11 or 12 years, he's the lead guitar player. He's got his own group and a new record coming out tomorrow. You're hearing a little of Time on My Hands, which is the title track. I tell you this because, A, it's a great record, and B, John Harrington will be at our Linda Norris Auditorium on September 1st with his group, taking a break from his touring activities, supporting Steely Dan and the Dukes of September. And he'll be there live at the Linda on September 1st. Greg Ward and Fred Breglia are our guests on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551, the number. And Fred, you have a couple of announcements to make.
Yeah, we have a couple of upcoming events. The first one that I'll mention is going to be on August 12th at 2 p.m. And it's actually a free concert open to the public. You do not have to be a member of the Arboretum to attend it. You can just come. Certainly, donations are always welcome. It's going to be featuring two different bands. The first one is going to be what we call the Amazing Dunn Family String Ensemble. Now, these are it's a band of young adults to kids. The oldest one is going to be 18 years old, and the youngest one is 12. And they're getting accolades, music awards. I'm really excited to see these guys.
The Dunn Family Singers, is it?
It's the Amazing Dunn Family String Ensemble. And the other half of the program would actually be featuring the Upper Catskill String Quartet. So it's going to be an evening of string music, or I should say an afternoon of string music on August 12th at 2 p.m. And it's free to the public. Again, donations are always welcome. The other thing I want to mention briefly is that we will do our what we call perennial forest 5K cross-country run/walk. Ooh. And that's going to be Saturday, August 18th. And registration starts at 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, and the race begins at 9:30 sharp. And it's an official 5K race. This is actually going to be our sixth year doing it. We would say sixth annual, but since we really like perennials, we say sixth perennial.
Oh, aren't you guys clever? Oh,
wearing an old 5K shirt today.
Fair enough.
What day is that again?
This is going to be on August 18th. It starts officially at 9:30 and registrations from 8 to 9. And we have about 100 T-shirts to the first 100 registrations. That'll be free.
Okay, so, and you can find out more at your website, right?
Yes, www.landisarboretum.org. You could print off the registration form right online, and you could send it in.
All
right. You could also register right on the day as well.
All right, fair enough. Let's go back to the phones and Tim and Gilderland. Tim.
Hey, I'm doing good. You could do a great service for me, and I think for a lot of other people, if you give me some advice on this. When I plant things, like tulips bloom for like about a half an hour, May or June, whatever. All right, let's say 2 weeks.
Okay.
But how do you systematically advise people to have some bloomings that are in May, June, July, and so on, if that's possible to do?
Yeah, well, the easiest thing I would tell you to do, because it really varies so much, so to just give a general, you know, these are the things to do. Everyone's going to need something different. So, but the way I would go about when any time that I've done any perennial garden design is basically I make a list of, first thing I do is I draw out my space. And let's just say it's, you know, whatever, 5 feet wide, 10 feet long is my bed, whatever it might be. And then you, I always like to design, and this is for woody plants, perennials, whatever. I like to always pick more or less the idea conceptually wise before I start to think about plants. So you want to have always, usually, if it's a border that has like a backdrop to it, you always usually want your lowest stuff in the front and medium stuff in the middle and the higher stuff in the back. If it's going to be something that's viewed from all sides, then you would want your highest stuff in the middle and then medium stuff, you know, surrounding it, and then smaller stuff in front of that. And then the other thing I would do is recommend pulling out and creating a sort of a chart. And then you start by, you know, the chart basically goes early spring, mid-spring, late spring, early summer, midsummer, late summer, so forth and so on, all the way through till, you know, late fall. And perhaps even winter interest in some of the things you actually leave up, like tall grasses and things like that, to create some really good winter interest. So you've got your chart of basically all your seasons. And then below that chart, so that's one line. The other line is low, medium, high. And if you want to get more technical, you could put very low, you know, medium, medium high, high, very high, whatever. You could break it apart by feet and then go through and look online, look in plant catalogs, find things that will fit those different things that look like something that you would want, and then figure out in your chart where it's going to go. And then once you know that, then you can plug it into the bubbles that you did on your little landscape plan. And that's just a good general rule. Yeah. To try to figure out what's going to, because that's how you get seasonal bloom. You look at what you want, when it's going to bloom, plug it into some kind of roll, and you should have no problems with that.
And just to add, we at Ward's we do make some little handout lists for you. If you, I'm not sure that they're actually on the website for you to download, but you could email and then we could send them to you. If you did that at the wardsnursery.com website, there's an email link, and if you wanted to get that list, I'm sure we could get it to you.
Great.
The other thing I was going to say, though, is at Fred, you know, director of the Landis Arboretum over in the Berkshires, we have the Berkshire Botanical Garden. These are places that have perennial flowers, annual flowers, woody shrubs, you know, in bloom, and their whole job is to try to create something of interest all season long. So visiting these sites, it's a lot of garden tours happening both in all of the counties around here still throughout August. So going on a little trip with a little notepad, as Fred was saying, to take notes about what you see now and what you like.
Yep.
Lastly, asking a few people, hey, tulips, you know, I realize they don't bloom very long, but what else is going to look like a tulip in April and May? I mean, you just can't get that otherwise. And B, there's a lot of fun perennials that will bloom a long time, and you just need to sort of ask around a little bit.
Yep. What about roses?
Roses, most roses bloom a long time.
A long time, yeah. So you can see them all pretty much the season, right?
Yep.
And you could also think about possibly using, and since you brought up roses, which are more of a woody plant, you could think about other flowering woody plants, which basically give you a lot of bloom throughout the entire summer in a lot of cases. And a lot of times, you know, it's getting to be, I think, more popular where you see woody plants mixed in with perennials. So you kind of have both going on. And that can become, in a lot of cases, the backbone of your of your garden. If you have some flowering shrub that just keeps going, there's like Charabana spirea, going to bloom two-tone flowers most of the summer. Mix that in with perennials, now you got a lot more flower power and sometimes a lot less work, too.
Yeah, that's actually very helpful because a lot of people are like laymen like me. We don't know. And I know, like, we have a forsythia, I think it's called a forsythia bush here.
Yep, forsythia,
blooms for, like, 2 weeks in the spring.
Great color in the spring. Doesn't last real long, but it's a wonderful plant.
And the thing is, it's really helpful for people to know that they can have some blooming in June, July, and August.
They sure
Absolutely,
can.
Absolutely, yeah. They can. They can have a lot of flower. A lot of flower.
All right, Tim, we're going to move it along.
Thanks so much.
Yep, thank you very much. We go to Janet in Pittsfield. Hi, you're on Vox Pop. Hello? Are you there? I can hear us. All right, going once, Janet. Okay, I think Janet has lost interest. Thanks. Let's go to Layla in Mount Tremper. Layla.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not sure if this is exactly a gardening question, but your guys seem really knowledgeable. When I moved to the Catskills 15 years ago, I noticed something that I hadn't grown up with in the Philly area, which was it seemed like a distinct shift in season right around the beginning of August from what I would call summer to something that felt like late summer. Like the clouds seemed different, the temperature started to drop, and the sound of the night insects changes. And so I just wondered if your guys have noticed something like that. Second, whether they know anything about the night insects. I'm just curious about it because it really struck my attention. And third, if there's anything in particular marked by that change, it's good for the garden.
Wow.
Well, I'm sure Fred has put a few of those night insects in a blender at one time or another, but go ahead.
I actually don't know, that much about the specific species or even, groups, genus, families of what is making noise other than, there's some crickets out there. There's probably, something else that is an insect making noises. And I hear them all the time. They're not so hard to look up. There's a lot of, if you sort of look online for insect noises, so you go to the website, you find some noises, you listen, or songs, whatever they're called, you listen to them, you can identify those things. And they're, they're regional, so I'm sure you could find out what it is. But I would have to say, I've lived in the Berkshires pretty much my whole life, and the August brings on a new sound, certainly late July sound. Everything runs kind of on the same thing. They all run on the length of time the soil is warm generally, and possibly is the solstice as well. So August is bringing on all these insects because it's just the time of year. They've had all this other time to develop. They were probably in some other life stage, younger life stage prior to this. Now they're in an adult life stage making noise to attract each other.
Interesting. Briefly. Chinese medicine actually talks about five seasons, and it's this, we usually think of four, and the season that they have that we don't have normally in Western culture is something called late summer, early autumn, and it sounds like it's corresponding to what you're talking about.
Interesting.
I actually have noticed that in the fall, there's often like almost two falls, too.
There's football season.
Well, there's three falls, if you want to call it that way.
The days, significantly shorter now, though, as well. Right. And so I think it's very noticeable for all of us. And so I see August as a different season for sure.
Hey, Layla, thanks a lot. That's a great call. Let's go now. Let's see if we can get Janet from Pittsfield. Hello, testing 1, 2, 3. Janet, are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome aboard.
Hi. I have two endless summer hydrangeas that have bloomed beautifully every year. And this year, there isn't a bud on them.
They didn't bloom this spring at all?
Not at all.
And so any heavy pruning happened last fall?
No.
So they were left up and kind of, sticky looking with a few leaves on them all winter long and allowed to grow out in the spring all on their own.
Yes. And they're not near each other. They're in two separate areas.
Yeah,
that
wouldn't make any difference. What probably happened was they leafed out this spring very early, as everything did, and there was in one of those minor cold snaps, whether that was in April or I don't think there were any in May, but I think there might have been, maybe there was one in early May, froze the very tips of the newest growth, which is where the flower buds, the spring flower buds, would be waiting.
Okay.
Those buds, you may not have noticed this because you were doing other things in the garden, but those buds were unable to continue to open. New side shoots came up around those, but without flower buds and just leaves.
Mm-hmm.
So they were essentially stopped. It was stopped in its tracks and then started to grow again from lateral shoots and filled out with leaves only. The thing with Endless Summer is it's supposed to set buds now for late summer and fall. So ideally, you would start to see some new buds forming again.
Okay. Now. I've looked. I don't see anything, but I'll keep looking. Yeah. Now, fertilizing, too late to fertilize for
Not for a plant that wants to bloom again, not at all. No. Roses, hydrangea, or endless summer hydrangea specifically, great time to feed them.
Okay. But generally with like woody plants and things like that, you're going to want to wait things that are not ready to bloom again, just to clarify for the other listeners, you'd want to wait till more or less like I'd say, if you want to call it this, late fall.
Why?
Because there's two falls.
No. I got that from the last. No, why would you want to wait to fertilize?
Because if you go too early, what could happen is now with the plant that Greg mentioned, they want to bloom again, so they're looking for food and they want to grow again. But most other plants are not looking to grow again, so fertilizing them too early, it's beyond that actually. It could actually potentially stimulate growth, force them to grow again, and then that new growth could get damaged.
I see.
In the winter.
Makes sense.
So wait till they're kind of sleeping. Hit them with fertilizer. It's a great time for uptake. Roots keep pulling it in. Spring, it's in place, and they're happy.
Janet, thanks a lot. I'm glad you finally made it through. Okay. Well, that was all right. Abrupt. Steve in Bethel. Steve, you're on.
Hey. Okay. Of all the questions I'd love to ask you guys, I wanted to discuss stink bug. Not so much this year, but last year there was a lot in the papers in our area about how there was an infestation.
Well, there's stink bugs which are native and they're nothing. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. They're actually quite good. You know, they're not bad for plants and things like that. They're not a problem. But then there's an invasive one called the marimated stink bug, and that's the one that is a problem. So if you're online, I would recommend looking up marimated stink bug, and that's the one. It'll have pictures of that on like the invasive species. If you typed in like invasive species New York State or
how did they get here?
The exact way is unknown, but almost always they're brought over with some intervention with man, usually brought over on packing pallets or a lot of times in nursery stock is another huge one. We move nursery stock around, comes over and
where are the marimated stink bugs from?
I'd have to double check that, but I think that they're native to Asia, but I could be wrong on that one, but I'm pretty sure that that's correct.
So it could have come in on almost anything.
Most problematic, invasives are in the same temperate zone, but on that other continent over there.
You know, exactly.
They can deal with our weather just fine. They just don't have any predators.
So if we actually exported anything to Asia, we could return the favor.
Exactly. We actually
already, that's another Vox
Pop. That's already been done.
Oh, really?
We've given out almost as much as we've received in terms of invasive species.
Interesting. All right, you want to follow up, Steve?
Well, yes, I'd like to discuss it. Basically, I do know, well, let me say that I've virtually eradicated my Japanese beetle problem by getting out there with a pot of soapy water and knocking them off my plants over the years.
Congratulations.
That's an effective way to go. That works well.
It's a great way to go because you disrupt their breeding cycle and then every year there's less. My neighbors are inundated and I'm not. So I guess my question about the stink bugs was, I know some of them are carnivores and good, some of them are not. I'm finding a very small one on my browned out seed pods from my columbine. They seem to love it. When I harvest seeds, I notice it's very sticky. The columbine, maybe they're attracted to something on the columbine that's sweet or sticky. My question was, how do I know which ones are bad? These are really tiny ones, and I've got tons of them.
Yeah, the best thing, like I said, would be to basically go to the
and see which ones are invasive.
The New York State Invasive Species Council. There's also a number of other invasive species organizations out there that are putting out. I mean, there's a lot of invasive species is a hot topic right now. Anyone that's driven around the roads in New York State and seen purple traps knows that there's something going on. And we're also hanging up these black traps at the Arboretum, which are for the Asian longhorn beetle, which may be even significantly worse pest, which is not here in our zone right now, not in our area, thank God. But there's such good resources available online with fantastic pictures. And the thing is, the pictures are often large and your insect is often small. So anytime that people call up the Arboretum and ask me those kinds of questions, I always say, get even an inexpensive magnifying glass out. Get your insect and look at it with a magnifying glass so you can, because it's going to look a lot different under a hand lens than it will by the naked eye.
And briefly, I think if they're really tiny, it's pretty unlikely it's that invasive. That invasive one is that one that you find in your house. It's pretty large. It's brown.
No. It's not the big brown ones. These are very small, size of a mat head, brown. And so I should leave them? You think they're good?
Look online, because the marimated stink bug is smaller than all the other stink bugs.
Yeah, these aren't brown. I just want to make sure they're not herbivores. If they're carnivores, I'm happy to leave them. But there are hundreds and hundreds.
Oh boy!
I guess I have researched it. It's hard to find which ones are bad. I guess I have to do some better research.
Hey, send us a photo if you want to send me a photo.
Yeah,
I'd
likewise.
Love to figure that out.
All right, the email address again, gentlemen,
is wardsnursery.com or info@wardsnursery.com
or fred@landisarboretum.org.
I know there's people waiting. I'm pulled over on the side of the road.
We got a break anyway. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. It is the gardening show, and a good one it is. 800, the guests are good anyway. 800-348-2551. Me, not so much, but we'll be back with you. You're doing all right as well. Coming up.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Adams Ferriker Farms, Kingston, Poughkeepsie, and Newburgh, New York. Trees, shrubs, blooming perennials and annuals, bedding plants, gardening supplies, birding supplies. AdamsFerrikerFarms.com. A.D. George Construction, for over 25 years serving the Pioneer Valley's residential construction needs, remodeling, additions, and more from design to completion. 413-256-6752. Hudson River Valley National Heritage Area, announcing Hudson River Valley Ramble. Weekends in September, events showcasing the natural and cultural resources of the Hudson River Valley. HudsonRiverValleyRamble.com. SPAC, presenting the 22nd Annual Saratoga Chamber Music Festival, sponsored by WAMC and WMHT, featuring the Worcester Quartet, performing Boccherini, Debussy, Donani, Tuesday, August 7th in the Spa Little Theater, SPAC.org. And Valentine Communications, Pleasant Valley, New York, providing sound, lighting, and video event production support for 25 years in the tri-state area. 845-635-8606.
It's Vox Pop. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Fred Breglia is here, and also Greg Ward. Greg, you have a couple of things you'd like to say.
Yeah. First, there are a lot of bugs out there, and at Ward's we get a lot of people bringing us in little samples all the time. The first thing I always like to say is, 99% of those things are native, normal. Even if they're somewhat exotic, they're not hurting most things. Err on the side of caution. Don't just hose them down with some insecticide because they're piled up on something. Could be a nice natural event. So I just wanted to mention that. Are a few bugs that we've been talking about that you definitely, if you have some time and you want to go online and look up, Asian longhorn beetle are a great thing to sort of know what it looks like. And there are some copycats out there, beetles that look similar but are not a problem. And then that emerald ash borer is a beetle moving through New York State here. Mm-hmm. Not sure if you already have it, Fred, but
no, it's a county.
It just showed up in Connecticut, apparently.
County away from us, I believe.
Yeah, so it's around. And these are the kinds of bugs that it wouldn't be a bad idea to know what they look like. And if you see them, just allow the local people, the Extension Service, et cetera, to know that you've seen it. Mm. Other than that, You mentioned late blight, early blight on tomatoes. And
yes.
There are some signs, unfortunately, of late blight, which is the bad one.
Okay, now, the difference between early blight and late blight.
Yeah, briefly, late blight does in the plant from the top down black spots, starting on the newest upper leaves and stems. The plant has a little bit of a white fuzziness, you know, the little fruiting bodies of a fungi usually forming on that black spot, usually on the underside of the leaf.
You really have to look, though, right?
You would want to walk up to the leaf and look.
Okay.
It is starting to show up in some of the, we've heard Dutchess County, Litchfield County, Connecticut, Dutchess County, New York, and possibly Berkshire County. If you're good air circulation around your tomatoes, water from the base only, don't get the foliage wet, don't wander around through your tomatoes when they're damp, okay, or if the help is, because you can actually help spread the spores.
Okay.
And then if you're concerned, and there is some recommendation of this, though I've held off so far, you can apply fungicides, and there are a couple of organic pesticides or fungicides, that would be effective, copper sulfate solution and a thing called Bacillus subtilis, which is a biological bacteria that affects negatively affects the fungus.
So that's late blight. The one we had in one of our cherry tomatoes was turned black. The tomato itself turned black on the bottom.
Oh, it's blossom end rot.
Yeah.
I beg your pardon?
It's called blossom end rot.
And what is that? It will affect my salads, clearly, but is there any hope?
Well, the thing is, actually, a lot of times you'll see that because of a couple of reasons. One of them is actually water stress.
Okay. Too much?
Not enough. Not enough water.
Well, it's
usually
been pretty dry.
It can also be a calcium deficiency is another thing. There's a few reasons. Basically, get rid of that one and let the other ones come
on.
The
other ones seem okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so a couple other leaf blights out there, you know, early blight, another thing called Septoria. I can't think of the... So there's a few little leaf blights that tomatoes can get. Generally, if it's happening from the bottom up, you're okay. Just keep your plants healthy and vigorous, and you will ideally stay ahead of it for the season. Remember to rotate where you plant your tomatoes. Try to have three spots so that you never plant them in the same spot again for 2 years.
Okay. Just because of nutrients,
because
or why?
Because the potential for the fungi, both the early blights, the less harsh ones, and the late blight, to winter over in the same spot are always present.
Amazing. Amazing.
And, of course, lastly, pull up all your plants at the end of the season, roots and all, try not to have any debris left in the planting location.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to the phones and to Jackie and Beckett. You're on.
Hi. I have a new garden that is really basically terribly rocky soil, and I've been building it up, you know, with compost in the beginning. Should I do that for the winter, like put something on it to build it up? There's perennials planted in there.
Yeah, I usually would recommend applying compost to gardens in particular. You could apply them in spring, you could apply them in the summer, you could apply them in the fall. I don't think necessarily winter time would be the ideal time because the ground's frozen. And,
No. I'm not going to have flowers after.
In the fall?
I'm going to leave it, you know, here for the winter.
There's some issues with creating a home for specifically voles, but any creature that might want to also feed on the roots of your plant. So if you have a true compost and it is nice and soil-like, adding that to your garden and working that gently so that it's not you know, obvious that there's these big piles anywhere that they could hide into, that would be great. But if you're chopping up all your leaves and you're thinking about, well, maybe I could just throw my leaves on the garden for the winter, you might want to wait till spring.
No, I'm going to go to Ward's Nursery and buy some compost.
Okay.
There you go. All right, fine.
So you can do that anytime.
Okay.
And I can compost it twice a year?
More than that.
Yep.
More than that, okay.
Yeah, just top dressing in general with compost. Like even if you don't mix it all in, even if you just spread it around, it's a good quality compost. It actually creates a vertical action in the soil on its own. So if you just spread it around, you could do that, you know, frequently around the top of your plant. In fact, with perennial gardens, I like to say that one of the best mulches is probably a good organic compost. Just top dress and it's going to get in there, and it creates a really nice network of airspace and water pipes for your plants.
Okay, do you fertilize too? I didn't use any fertilizer.
If you're composting frequently, then you are fertilizing.
Yeah.
You are doing. You're
That's
adding enough
okay.
to fertilizer.
Jackie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye. Let's go to Hargary and Saugerties. You're on.
Hi, Ray. It's Marjorie from Saugerties.
Well, I'll be darned. I didn't get that. Oh, it looked like an H. Marjorie, how are you?
I am great. How are you?
Welcome aboard.
Thank you. Thank you. A wonderful program, as always.
Thank you.
My question is about transplanting or not Fuji trees. Our lawn used to slope down, and I planted 3-foot-high Fuji trees. This is their fifth season. And now my husband is building a woodshed and wants to level out the yard. I was under the impression that if you put soil around the trunk, they would die.
If you put soil right around the actual trunk, it's not a good thing. That's going to create a stem rot or a root flare rot, which is going to decline the plant over time. Mulching, soil, any of that stuff, what I call volcano mulch, built up around the stem is not good. Adding mulch around the root zone or adding soil around the root zone, which is, you know, not, again, not on the trunk, is not necessarily bad. It would depend on the depth of which you would be adding it. And anything up over 4 inches of soil would begin to cut down on the air exchange process. That's what the problem is that, you know, everyone knows the leaves are breathing, but the roots are also breathing just very much like the leaves are. And there's an exchange of gases, air, oxygen, carbon dioxide, is going into the roots through the soil profile, and it's being secreted by the roots, and it's going has to diffuse back out into the atmosphere. So if you go up over 4 inches, that will definitely cut down on that air exchange process, and therefore create a problem with your plants. So, it would depend on how much you want.
Yeah,
to add.
What's the grade change?
I pulled over to the side of the road, so I don't have my husband to ask.
Okay, how big are the trees? Now,
The trees are maybe 6 feet
great,
tall.
Yes. So not a bad thing to be able to transplant. It is, you know, something that can be dug and moved, believe it or not, starting usually in August, as early as August. September would probably be a better month. October would be a great month.
Oh, good.
You do not have to wait for cold weather to dig and transplant those. You would want to wait or at least add plenty of water. You would not want to be moving these things in a drought situation. So the day you're ready to do it, you should have been watering for a week or 10 days on a regular basis, maybe every 2 or 3 days, to make sure they're well hydrated.
Okay.
Okay. Now, just one final question.
Sure.
If my friend has a backhoe, and he offered to come and dig them up with a backhoe, that made me nervous.
I think if you know someone who's dug up a 6-foot tree before, an arborvitae is a good one to start on. They have a nice fibrous root system.
Yeah,
it pops right out of the ground and usually holds on to a lot of soil all by itself. You don't really have to worry about it too much. But a backhoe, unless they are very good with it and feel very comfortable going around the tree, not just sort of ripping the tree up, I would hesitate. Sure.
Okay.
But I've used backhoes many times to do that. So it can work, but as Greg said, you do need to kind of be careful and also digging around. The key is not with the backhoe, it's almost actually not so much digging the ball of the tree. It's actually digging everything around the root ball of the tree. And then all you're left with is undisturbed soil around your trunk. And then you come in and you could kind of finish it with maybe a hand spade.
Okay.
Okay, I thank you very much.
Marjorie, thanks a lot. Let's go to Kat in, is it Cali?
Kat in California.
Are you listening online?
Yes, we are. My friend Myrna lives in New York, and she listens to you all the time, and so I'm sitting here with her listening to you, and I'm like, I wonder if they can help me out.
Sure thing.
Okay, well, I have this ficus that is just the biggest ficus I've ever seen. It's in our backyard. It's absolutely gorgeous. But the roots are starting to go under the house.
Oh, yeah.
And so my concern is, it's about, from what I understand, it's about 25 years old.
Okay.
And so somebody once said that it's done growing. If you just chop the roots, it should be fine. But that doesn't sound right to me.
Well, I would say first thing, I've dealt with all sorts of tree root barriers and tree interference, you know, root interference, all kinds of stuff like that. So there's a lot of variables here. But first off, how do you know that the roots are going under your house or into your house?
Well, there's a like a walkway, and the cement is all
heaved.
It looks like an earthquake hit it.
And this is
so
it's just in the walkway that you're noticing it.
And the, but the walk area is right next to the house. It's like bumped up to the house. So
okay.
If those are up like that, the roots got to be going into the house.
Okay, because what you find when you pull up that material, and, you know, I've seen, like I said, pretty extensive jobs where you rip all the concrete out and see what's going on. There's been a lot of research with this. But what you find is that the roots are opportunistic, so they're going to grow wherever there's really an opportunity for them.
Okay.
And when I say opportunity, what they're looking for is basically like a nutrients, water, air. Those are the main three things. So if it has a choice in growing through, you know, solid concrete is not really a good opportunistic place for them to grow. Now, the reason why you see sidewalks heaved up and problems like this occurring is that there's often cracks in the sidewalk. So then those cracks form little opportunities for those roots to kind of follow those cracks. And then once those roots are following those cracks, then they get larger and then they start to heave the material. So my guess would be that, you know, they're not necessarily invading your foundation. You know, again, I haven't seen the site, but they're probably just finding cracks in the in amongst the concrete to grow. And then when they do that, they just get larger and heave it. So those roots, you know, as long as they're not necessarily main structural roots, can probably be, you know, cut and removed.
And your house has a foundation?
Yes.
It goes down a few feet?
Yeah.
And it's not a wet place. You're in Southern California, I assume.
Yeah, so we're in Southern California in Camarillo.
And you don't have, you have a sprinkler system or?
I do, yeah.
So like Fred said, you know, if you're creating a good condition next to the house for the roots to expand, then sure, they're going to head that way. But if you don't, then it's less likely they're going to push into your foundation. And how, just briefly, how big is this tree, the thickness of the trunk?
Goodness gracious. About as wide as I could put my arms.
Wow.
It's gigantic.
And so, and it's only 3 feet from your house?
It's about, yeah, I would say it's about 8 feet from the house.
Yeah. So it's going to be there. I mean, no matter what, there's going to be roots up near the foundation. And I don't know that. I think you need someone to come take a look.
Yeah, I would recommend calling a certified arborist is definitely where you want to go with that.
Hey, Kat, thanks a lot for call. Go ahead, finish it up.
It's just one of those things that you need to see it to know what to do with it.
I think so.
It sounds like it. I would agree to kind of. But there's also things that are called like root barriers that could be installed, and you could certainly live with the tree there. But again, I would definitely not recommend just calling any tree service.
Right.
This is something more specialty. And if you go online to the International Society of Arboriculture's website, it's, I believe, www.isa-arbor.com.
Okay.
You'll find a certified arborist in your area, or you can look in the phone book. Maybe there's some listed.
Right.
Get a certified arborist in here. Have just a general consultation.
All right, Kat, thanks a lot. We're going to move it along, but it's very cool to get a call from California.
Yeah.
We appreciate it
very
much.
Much.
Let's go to John in Gloversville. John, you're on.
Hi. I have a fruit tree, which I found out today is a plum tree because there was one on the ground. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Sure.
Okay, anyway, there's a branch, not an actual branch, it's like an offshoot of the trunk coming up, and it's about 6 foot long now, running right up vertically with the trunk. Seems more like an additional trunk than it does. Should I cut that off so it doesn't break? The tree is probably 15 to 17 feet tall now, although it's very still young.
Yeah, that's basically what we would call a sucker. It grows up straight. It's just a sucker gone wild. Usually you see them and they're fairly small, but if you do let them go long enough, one sneaks by. I've seen them that, you know, they can get as big as a tree. Long term, if you left enough suckers go, they would actually overtake the tree. But that's something that would be removed. Yep.
Yeah,
but
suckers will take over, that's for sure, at some point.
So it's about 6-7 feet long now.
And pruning it now would be a good idea, and pruning it at the base of where it's emerging, leaving that little swelling between the original trunk and the branch, so that you just leave a little bit of it left there.
And then paint it with some of that black stuff?
Actually, no. That stuff's been proven to not work at all.
Yeah. Oh. And it'll be all set by itself.
Yep.
All
right. Oh, so it won't rot. Okay.
No, the key is the trees don't heal, they seal. So they have to close up the wounds, and that kind of stuff can actually prevent trees from sealing. So,
alrighty.
So no pruning paints.
We are out of time, John. Thanks a lot. Thanks to everybody, including those who didn't make it through. Fred Breglia, your contact information one more time.
It's going to be Fred at Landis Arboretum. You can also go to the website, www.landisarboretum.org.
And Greg Ward?
WardsNursery.com or info@WardsNursery.com. We love to answer your emails, or 413-528-0166 is the phone number.
All right. You know, that was a good show today.
Was.
Yeah. We learned
California.
A lot. No bugs were injured in the making of this program. It was pretty good. Support for WAMC comes from the Phantom Gardener Nursery, Rhinebeck, New York, dedicated to helping gardeners go green with native plants, organic seedlings, and supplies, organic from the start, sustainable for the future, thephantomgardener.com. Northshire Bookstore hosting Jay Lutz presenting Stand Up That Mountain, Friday, August 3rd, 7 p.m., northshire.com. The Last of the Mohicans Outdoor Drama, Lake George, New York, presenting drama and presentation celebrating local history through August 18th, lastofthemohicans.org for schedule. And H. Houst and Son True Value, Woodstock, New York, since 1932, a local store featuring indoor and outdoor home and garden products and professional project consultations. True Value, start right, start here, HHOUST.com. Thanks again for joining us for Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incredible Zachary Malloy, relatively incredible. Thanks to Kelly McGuire for answering the telephones today. Our producer, Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Moyers & Company tomorrow on Medical Monday next week at 2. It's Lyme disease with Dr. Daniel Cameron. Stay tuned now for a news update.